This is Beyond the Wall, a Game of Thrones LCG podcast brought to you by Istril and Darknotch. We'd like to thank Fantasy Flight Games for our hobby and their continued support, Drew Dallas at Card Game DB for our hosting, and the AGOT community as a whole for making this possible. Let us take you beyond the wall. Welcome to another episode of Beyond the Wall. In today's episode, we'll be doing a brief intro in which we go over some of the week's news and some of the past regionals. And then we'll have a segment transferring the wisdom of the ages from a past Melee champion into adapting your joust game to Melee. Finally, we'll have some closing segments where we discuss the tournaments coming up over this next week. So this is episode 24, and you know why 24 is an amazing number, John? Long silence. No, John. Where's John?
Babysitting.
So I'm joined today by Raul. I have no idea where John has gone. I hope he's okay. I haven't heard from him today, so we're trying to get the recording done at the last minute. But 24 is how many years since Germany last won the World Cup? Which is pretty good timing for episode 24. I'm pretty pleased with the way that works out. I watched the final today and woke my brand new born daughter up so she could watch the last 3 minutes and burp on my Germany jersey. But I was very pleased with the end result. We don't generally spend a lot of time talking about sports on this podcast, but it is the World Cup. So, any news that you can think of this week, though?
Maybe the regional seasons.
Yeah, so there have been a couple of regional tournaments this week, most of which have given me data in the annals or have promised it. The one that specifically reached out to me and mentioned that there should be some props was the Singapore regional, which was 21 players, and the final included Berra versus Berra. So props to them for bringing Berra up to the finals. And in the end, the Maester's Path won over the Knights of the Realm.
St. Petersburg was delayed or something.
There was also one in Canada. There was one in Halifax. It wound up being quite small, about 10 players, but it was won by a Lanny Power behind the throne. And I think the player that reached out to me with that was really hoping that tournament would wind up in Moncton or in New Brunswick next year, because the local meta in Halifax is very, very small. I don't think FFG is very good with geography of countries other than the United States.
Sure.
They leave it up to the local distributors. I assume distributors choose the regional locations in Spain?
I think it was our own company, Edge.
Edge, yeah. So the local distributor gets to choose that.
Yeah.
Okay. Aside from that, there was a regional that was a Norwegian regional that was moved to Sweden, but I don't have any information from that. There's a weekly tournament in Padis. What happened this week in Padis?
This weekend, I think there were 7 players. Jeff won with Martel, No Agenda. Rivers,
right.
And Ariane.
Plus,
crazy,
right.
Stuff, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And then there was because we had the German language card pool talk, there was actually an English language tournament in Salzburg with the full pool. And that was won by Targ, No Agenda. And I think that's a deck we're going to see a lot of now that Danny's out.
Yeah, Dania Harrenhal. Yeah.
It makes that deck very, very powerful.
Yep.
Yeah, it's been a fairly slow week for regionals, but they certainly are going to pick up over the next 2 weeks. But I'm somewhat surprised. In the Annals of Castle Black, we still haven't seen a single entry for Dark Wings, Dark Words. Nobody's even trying it out.
Or maybe they're trying and they want to keep bats after the regional seasons. I don't know.
Yeah.
But the agenda is quite funny. I have to congratulate Corey for the designing.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's challenging, and I just haven't had the time to look at it, to tear it apart. I think we'll see something out of it, but I don't know. It feels like there are a lot of builds that might work with it that rely on rivers, so it's not a very good idea to do that now.
Yeah.
When we're expecting, FAQ will probably affect that. Speaking of which, when would you expect to see the FAQ?
Hopefully before Blackwater Bay, in London before because I'm going, and I don't want to face more nonsense of rivers.
So the Blackwater Bay is on the 26th, I think, the weekend of the 26th and the 27th?
Yeah.
See, I don't think that's very likely, because I know that there are two stateside regionals on that weekend as well.
Yeah, the DC.
The DC one, for instance. And I think that they're going to wait. My guess would be that Monday the 28th we'll see the new FAQ. But we haven't heard anything official. Does that count as early July?
Maybe it's early August, and we'll see them in September. Who knows?
Well, it definitely has to come before Gen Con, or it should come before Gen Con. But it does put us in a bit of a tight spot, because Canadian Nationals is on August 2nd and 3rd. So if they delay a little too long, it becomes very, very hard to say, oh, yeah, it's the new FAQ, and you have one day to rebuild your decks. So
that would be awesome.
It would be a very wild meta,
yeah,
I suppose.
That happens once in one battle for the world. The FAQ came out a week before the tournament, and the meta changing was crazy. Everybody was trying new decks and new ideas.
I guess it could be pretty neat. Sort of like the Gen Con warm-up. Nobody knows what decks are going to come out of it.
Yeah. So I'd be surprised.
What else? I guess it probably means we have to do an episode about the FAQ next week. But I guess we'll leave that until then. Other news. Well, actually, since I have you on, in our episode last week, we were talking about localization issues, and they mentioned having a specific FAQ to correct translation issues. Does Edge do that as well for Spain? Do you have an FAQ that is then adapted for Spanish language cards?
I think there's an FAQ, but it's 2.2, the last one I saw in Spanish or so.
Oh, okay. So if a card is misprinted, like the example we've given before, where, for instance, Asha Greyjoy is Hija de Hierro instead of Hijo de Hierro, and therefore can't be used with Finger Dance, there's no errata to change that or to fix that for your card pool?
We just take the English FAQ and we say, okay, if in English we can play this with this, we should do this in Spanish.
Okay. So there's not as much official policy there from the distributors. It's more just the players saying,
yeah,
let's try to keep it together. Well, that's a shame, because I was very pleased to hear that the German distributor was making that effort. You know, whenever they made a mistake, they say, okay, look, we're going to...
What I saw this week was the emergency FAQ, and the article on FFG was translated. And
Okay, so they had the same... They translated the article.
Yeah.
But they didn't translate the FAQ?
I don't think so.
Okay. Well, that's great for any of you that can't read English. Must be rather unfortunate.
Yeah.
And then, aside from that, so today our episode was going to include a couple other things, as well as the segment that we have after about Melee and adapting to Melee, because there are many Melee tournaments coming. However, we did have some mic issues with our guest, and we had some crying baby issues, and surprisingly, they weren't on my side. My baby hasn't been crying. Someone else's baby was crying. So,
that's good.
Well, at least the listeners will get a taste of baby crying, and they can feel a portion of my new excitement.
We're joined today by the 2012 American National Melee Champion, Mike.
And how's it going?
So the topic today that I really want to talk about, because we're getting closer to Gen Con again, we're getting closer to other Nationals events.
Canadian Nationals!
Is that a lot of players who are traditionally Joust-only players then go a little bit out of their comfort zone and start playing Melee. But to start it off, maybe walk us through your glorious championship.
It was a heck of a tournament. I certainly got lucky in a lot of spots, which you kind of have to with Melee. I got some good table placements and some just great matches. Just playing Baratheon Rush, John and I had worked on it together, and by John and I mean mostly John. So it was just a real strong kind of Holy Rush deck with all the great renowned characters thrown in there. And, you know, it was a real good day, and I had just mostly a bunch of really great power rushes. My second game, I actually was at a table with Corey Faraday, and Corey's a great player and a great deck builder, and he had actually kind of taught me a very valuable lesson the year before about Melee, because he managed to table talk me into doing something very stupid, basically turned myself into the international bank of power for the rest of the table. That year, I kind of got to get revenge a little bit, and I managed to table talk him into kneeling out some of my opponents, and then I just, you know, rushed for the win and flipped Winter Festival the next plat phase and won it, you know, 20 minutes into the round. But really, the highlight of the entire tournament for me had to be my top 16 table. And I was playing with Morgan and Rob and John's friend Adrian. It was a pretty typical first round. You know, everybody kind of put their stuff out. Morgan was playing this Greyjoy Maesters deck where she wanted to get Horned Dragons out, do some trait manipulation, and, you know, steal somebody's character with a bunch of renown to a surprise win. And so I managed to talk Rob into using Nightmares in conjunction with my blanking plot to drop all the chains off her Maester. She had no chance of winning the match at all at that point. You know, her main trick had been taken away, and she was not going to recover. So she decided her best chance to improve her standing for overall was to help me win and take second. By convincing Rob to Nightmares her Maester, I basically ran away with the game and won in very short order, which, you know, I was pretty proud of, because table talk, I think, is one of the pillars of good Melee play, is knowing how to bargain, and, you know, I try to have a sense of honor about it and not break my bargains once I've made them. The last match was, I think it's on YouTube still, and there's probably somewhere that horrendous interview with me afterwards.
That was the first time I actually saw John.
I was trying to give John as much credit as I could, because really it was John's game. John should have won that game, but, you know, the DC meta, good old Brian Oreo, managed to snatch victory out of John's hands and deliver it into mine.
With a card that might actually be a pretty good jumping point. So, what was the card that turned that game into your hands?
Knights of the Storm, you know, changes who the first player is. John and I, since we had worked on the deck together and were playing the same deck, when I saw John go all out on the table, I knew that I was safe to go all out on the table as well. Everybody kind of laid all their cards out, and then we get to the next round, and the Targ player who's playing Super Rhaegal, if memory serves, so he had like 6 dupes on Rhaegal at that point or something. He Valored, just as I thought. John had a narrow escape in to save, and luckily I had 2 dupes on my Knight of Flowers and my Melisandre, which both had, you know, power on them. So I, unlike everybody else at the table who had to lose their power and then, you know, bring their characters back, I got to keep my power. And so John was sitting on, I think, what, 2 or 3 of the Vigilant Icons that, and he had Power of Faith revealed, so they were Tricons with Stealth. Which were absolutely beast. Whole tournament for me, and I'm sure the whole tournament for him. I mean, he was going second. It looked like for sure he was gonna take the match. Nobody was gonna be able to stop him. And then Brian marshaled a Knights of the Storm and took first player. You know, then there was a lot of talk about, you know, Brian, don't overextend yourself. You know, if you go for the win and then don't make it, you know, Mike's going to win, which is pretty much exactly what happened, is he extended himself just enough that I had out Edric Storm and a whole bunch of Renown characters, and I used the Wildling Bard to put Renown on 2 other characters as well. And so he kneeled out just enough that I had 4 challenges to push out 5 or 6 power, if memory serves. So it was just kind of a foregone conclusion at that point. I had more than enough challenges to make it. It's a great game. I played the best I could, but really the play of the game, the play that won it for me, was not even done by me.
That's a great story, because it does reflect a lot on Melee. There's so much going on at the table that you can't control everything, and you have to accept some of these knocks, and you have to accept some of the good things that happen to you too because of it. And Melee really does require a lot of different skills than Joust, because there's way more interaction with a whole bunch more people.
John, you mentioned that all these things, you know, sometimes you get hard knocks and there are so many different skills, but it's worth noting that it definitely is a skill set. The same players, the same high-quality players, tend to rise to the top. People who dismiss Melee as random are dismissive of the format for reasons I don't think they can justify.
Yeah, I would agree. If you look at the top cut for the last 3 years at Gen Con and Worlds, you're going to see that half that cut is going to be the same players each time. That, to me, speaks a lot to a skill-based game. Otherwise, you wouldn't be seeing that all the time. Why don't we talk briefly about, you know, what are the skills that make a good melee player? What do you think is the top three skills that make a good melee
player? I'd say that the top three skills are table talk, deck construction, obviously. You know, obviously you need to build your deck differently for melee. And not everybody does that. Some people will just take a solid joust deck and go, but I prefer to build a bit of a different type of deck for melee, which plays into the table talk because I like to have bargaining tools. You just play a joust deck, you don't have a whole lot of those. So I would say it's table talk, the deck construction, and then knowing how to read your opponents is really important. If you cannot kind of play sly and read your opponents, you're not going to get very far.
So the first one you mentioned there, table talk, let's go into that in a little more detail. So some people may not be familiar with the term. What do you mean when you say table talk?
Melee and Thrones is this really interesting game. It's not really, it's not like a whole lot of other competitive games. It's a lot of lying that goes on. There's a lot of half-truths. There's a lot of give and take. There's a lot of kind of hemming and hawing and bargaining and knowing when is too much and when's not enough.
So I think that one of the most important points for players to realize with table talk is that the goal is to make it always seem like whatever your opponent chooses to do is the best possible thing for him.
Yes.
So you're looking at that and you go, look, this other guy is 3 power from winning, you know, it's very dangerous. Even if you're ignoring the fact that he supports one other guy or this and that, however you word it, you need to word it in such a way, and you don't need to lie, you just need to make the case that whatever play you want him to make is the one that best advances his own position. And not to say, well, don't attack me because I've been nice to you earlier. That's not an argument that typically works very well.
No, it needs to have an element of self-interest, for sure, and an element of kind of overall game state, I guess.
And a lot of table talk is also using the right bargaining tools. So even if your deck isn't built to trade cards or things like that, you can almost always offer things like, I'll give you an unopposed power challenge if you do your military against this other guy. So you wind up with the same amount of strength, you get the same amount of power, but at least I get to keep a character. And some of that can work.
I support you, so you can let that go unopposed. I'll take care of it for you this time. In return, you will do.
Yeah, or you know, there was a year John and I played Power Behind the Throne, and offering that intrigue challenge to people was a really great bargaining tool the whole tournament. You know, well, you can intrigue challenge me, take a card, take a power, whatever does best for you. But, you know, that was a really great bargaining tool.
Mm-hmm. And so what are some other bargaining tools that you could potentially have? I mean, there are cards in your deck that you could say you're going to use against someone else. The next plot you're going to reveal, you reveal a Valor while you Valor. You can much and more.
And you can trade plots. There's, you know, lots of events that are good for that sort of thing. And as we discussed, you can use agendas. You know, you can also use things like negative attachments and stuff like that. Like, somebody's having a particular problem with, let's say, the Scourge, and you're playing Stark, you can say, well, if I took care of that Scourge for you, and you're sitting on a frozen solid, if I do that, how about you help me out with your next plot?
I mean, typically you wind up agreeing to these deals. Table talk works every single way. People are trying to convince you to do things, or make you notice things that you weren't noticing. You try to do it to everyone else. So you wind up making commitments, like, yes, I will reveal that next plot and give it to someone, or yes, I will let that opposed power challenge. So when do you back out of the commitment? When do you break your oath?
Well, I think that really depends on the player, and that's where personality and reading your opponents really comes into play. And there's definitely something to be said, you know, a little bit of an advantage if you know the people you're playing with, because you'll have a little bit of a better predictor as to how they'll behave. And everybody has a different breaking point. For me, I try to hold my deals as much as possible because I don't want to build a reputation as somebody you can't trust in melee.
For instance, I took a 3-place hit when I let Dan get an unopposed power challenge against me at that final table of the melee game that both Mike and I were at, when I had promised him the turn before that I would let him have an unopposed power under certain circumstances, and those circumstances happened, and he said, I now want to do my unopposed power, and I knew that based on the board state at that point that if I let that happen, I'd be moving from second place to fourth place at the table, and I still let it happen.
See, I'm probably just more of a bastard than either of you. I will honor agreements for as long as they don't threaten the win. So if it turns out that I think that giving someone an extra character with that summoning season this turn is putting him within striking distance of the win, that's when I break the deal. It's all self-interest. There's no point in me breaking deals on turn one when it's not going to give win or lose me the game. It's going to give me minor board positions, and people are going to hate me for having done it. But when it's closing the game, nah, all bets are off at that point. This is the Game of Thrones.
Some people pride themselves in being sneaky and breaking deals and being, haha, you should have never chosen your plot first. Now I can do a switcheroo and get a second summoning season off someone else. That gets around very quickly, and then the next time you're at a melee final table at the top 16, no one's going to trust you, and then you won't be able to make any deals.
I think the point is that you are playing to your own advantage, and you're doing all this. Or at least the way I see it, it's not dishonorable to break your word in a board game when you're playing for the win like that. Everybody should be playing for the win. Otherwise, you wind up with collusion. You wind up with these other issues where people are handing other people first place for no good reason.
I think there's one other thing I like to keep in mind when I'm playing melee, and that's pacing. I find that the people that tend to win are running decks that have a kind of a staggered pacing, where they have the ability to rush extremely quickly, but they don't do it on turn one, because I think you never want to be the guy with the most power after turn one.
Oh yeah, I see it as you definitely need an explosive finish. If people see you sitting at 12 power, they know that you're within striking distance of the win. If they see you at 6, they're more likely to underestimate you, and you can make a 9 power turn. And so that's where you want to be. If you start turn 1 strong, and many decks can, and end at 8 or 9 power, you're going to become a power dispenser over the next 3 turns. So what are some of the cards that people tend to use specifically for that that surprise win? First of all, the first ones I'd like to get out of the way is pretty much all of them on the melee restricted list. a good portion of those, the Make an Example, the Superior Claims. But what are some examples that you guys regularly see?
Mel's Favor.
Horn of Dragons is another
Horn example. Horn of Dragons.
Ygritte as well.
To the Spears is a big one for Martell, because it lets all the renowned characters quickly accelerate. Basically anything that doesn't yield a large portion of your renowned characters help a lot, you know, whether that's
Power of Faith.
Yeah, Power of Faith, Game of Thrones, Rain things like that.
Is also a very big one.
Rain of Steel can be a good closer late game. We saw John Bruno use that in 2013 in the Melee Final Table. He was playing a Rainy Steel deck.
Yep.
The Red Viper is very popular.
Conclaves used to be very popular. They've kind of fallen out of favor lately, but...
Because they hit the restricted list.
Yep, exactly.
Greyjoy has, you know, a couple good options. They have
Rise
an event. Yeah, Rise of the Kraken for a plot. They have an event that lets them claim 3 power if they kneel a character with a military crest.
And I think that might go really, really well into the next one I want to talk about that you guys haven't mentioned, and that's the touches back on the Knights of the Storm initiative in melee.
Yeah, I don't see that as a skill. I see that as part of deck building. I think you're right. I think it's super important to be able to choose who's going first at various points in the melee game.
Well, and it's important for all sorts of reasons. It's important for choosing order of resolution. It's important for deciding who chooses titles in what order. It can make a very big difference in the whole game and the round, of course.
In melee, initiative is much more important than in Joust. You're more likely to be able to get unopposed challenges if you time initiative right. You're more likely to, if you win initiative, worst case scenario, you don't want to deal with that problem. It's still a bargaining tool. Again, the ability to declare challenges and close the game when 2 or 3 people are in striking distance. There are just so many situations in which initiative allows you to control the game that if you're not paying attention to initiative in melee, I think it's a lost cause.
Yeah, this is one of the big things that I've noticed in a lot of melee games was that it was won almost entirely by the person going first on round 3. The person that went first, because there were so many people that were right close to being able to claim power, the person that went first and won that last 4 power or something won the game.
Titles, I think, is the next great point that I think we should talk about. It's probably the biggest mechanical difference between Joust and melee. And far more than the resources or what strength bonus they give, which people will always forget, the redirects, which are phenomenal tools, the support and oppose mechanics are what win you games.
Absolutely. I've seen the whole decks based solely around this support mechanic where they play a deck where they want to lose challenges, and the only way that they actually get to lose them is by supporting other players in challengers or redirecting the challenges to themselves to lose so that they can basically ensure that they continue to lose these challenges and therefore win the game.
Siege of Winterfell decks that try to pull military challenges to themselves with the Lord Commander or supporting challenges and things like that. How often could you have won the game if you didn't support that one guy who had, you know, not enough characters, or if you'd remembered to claim the power for opposing, you know, someone you were playing against?
Well, and when you're talking about these, you know, these explosive finishers and kind of, you know, going from 6, 7, 8 power all the way to win condition, every power really counts. And so you've got to be thinking about, well, you know, I can use this power grab event and I'm going to get renown on these two characters, and then I'll make sure that I attack him so that I get the power for somebody I oppose. Now, of course, we've got all these things that swap titles, which makes it even more complex because you got to think, you know, do I need to swap titles, or is this guy going to swap titles with me?
Other things that I can think of that are very different in Joust are actually cards that lose a lot of value in Melee rather than cards that gain a lot of value in Melee. So, for instance, many things that interfere with one opponent, a Castellan of the Rock or a Cancel, a Finger Dance, that kind of interference card, well, it used to interfere with your only opponent in Joust, but here it's only messing with the game plan of one of your three opponents, and they become much, much less valuable in those situations. Or, I mean, sometimes that Cancel can still win you the game, but you need to really look at them differently than you do in Joust. But I generally find that attachments survive a fair bit longer in Melee, again, because people are generally not running hate cards. Even the cards that you think of, like Dissension, that are great and that someone at the table is definitely running an ally or refugee, again, you're only affecting one opponent. Same thing with that attachment. You're stripping it from one opponent. And so most of the deck building is towards building up your position rather than knocking down any one opponent. So cards like attachments gain value.
And really, you don't want to knock down one of your opponents. You don't want to beat someone down to the point where everyone's going to be able to get unopposed from them, because that means all you're relying on at that point is that you can rush faster than the guy to your right and left. And that's dangerous. So to me, you don't want to beat someone down to the point where they're at a huge disadvantage compared to the rest of the table, especially on the first turns.
Other things that are very different in Joust, as you mentioned, the number of turns tends to be much shorter. So you can typically count on 3 or 4 of your plots being situational ones that you're going to use in those first 3 or 4 turns, which completely changes how you evaluate your plots.
Right, and with that same reason, these draw effects that kick in on turn 2 or turn, you know, 1 turn or 2 turns after you play them, like a Gold Tooth Mine, for instance, their value goes way down. If the games are only lasting 3 rounds and you're planning on playing your Gold Tooth Mine round 1, you're sacrificing board position for that card, and it's not even going to give you any draw until the next turn, at which place it just replaces itself, and you're not even going to get a value till probably the turn the game is about to end. So to me, these single card draws lose a lot of their value, and we start looking at other things to fill those spots.
And I think that one of the other aspects for why you can condense your deck more and is that you do get to use the titles to balance out your resource curve and use the summon plots and switch them to balance out your card curve. So you wind up getting to this point where you can actually, on the fly, if you win initiative or you have some control, maybe get the extra resources or the extra influence to ambush. And so your resource curve is naturally smoothened by the fact that there are the titles. Resources are handled fairly differently in Melee.
Like we were saying, you know, deck building, I think, too, you kind of tend to build a little more redundancy into your Melee decks because you're looking for a reliable result. And you can do some of this search and whatnot, and you can trade searches and use that to get, but usually you're trading that to get, you know, duplicates of your one power character.
Another aspect of deck building that I wanted to mention is that there are certain archetypes that you would think might work reasonably well in Melee, but they engender a lot of hate. So one of them that I can think of, for instance, is Choke. There are many Choke cards that affect all your opponents. The White Raven, Fear of Winter, Blockade, all these cards. But playing them will actually tend to turn you into a bit of a punching bag. There are actually some people who have had some really good success playing Burn, because not only can you control the challenges against you, but you can control the challenges between other players. If you feel like you really don't want the player to your right to win this power challenge, you can actually use a burn card, and that's a fairly important resource, and it's hard to balance it out. But if you are good at judging a melee table, some of those effects that can interfere with other people's challenges, where you're not necessarily sure, I think lethal counterattack, for instance, can actually just kill all attacking characters in someone else's challenge.
Yep.
So there are a lot of sneaky effects like that where you can say, you know what, I'm not just using this against challenges against me as a deterrent. I'm also using it to control the rest of the board and make sure that nobody wins before I do. But I think that takes a high level of skill. I wouldn't recommend it to players who have not played melee regularly.
Now, speaking of lethal counterattack, we have some newer alternatives to that in the environment for the other challenge types, don't we? Am I remembering correctly?
Yeah, we have Loyal to the Last, I think.
And Lashing Out.
And Lashing Out, yeah. Any challenge, beware.
I know for sure, previously, I've been very wary of any Stark player with two standing Stark characters when I'm issuing a military challenge. You've really gotta play it safe.
I guess the last card that's sort of on my list that I would like to hear your opinions on in Melee is Valor.
People are really opinionated on that one. There's some people who will tell you that you should never build a Melee deck without Valor.
Is there a Valor in the deck that you won with?
No, there was not. I go to the opposite side of that coin, and that's to say that in about 90% of the Melee decks I build, I will not run Valor, because I will assume that somebody else at the table is running it.
2 gold, 0 claim, super bad. Once you Valor, it is really hard for you to come back unless you had something on the board to maintain your board presence. In today's meta, I think it's very hard to do that.
I think that's exactly right, though. I think that the houses that are most likely to run it are Greyjoy, and then I would say any house that doesn't commit board position early. So anything playing, for instance, the Knights of the Hollow Hill, which we've seen more of in Melee in the last year or so,
right.
Because these decks are not committing many characters early on, so they can really hurt everybody else. They'll still get 4 gold, and then they can recover from that board position with the hand of cards that they've been using to control the board. Maybe use a Rainy's Hill to close the game. The rest of the time, I'd say only about a third of my decks have gotten it.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, what John says is absolutely correct. If you are the player who's forced into the position to Valor for the table, 99% of the time, you're not going to be the one winning that table.
Well, sometimes you only need second or third.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. But that comes to the difference in playing out rounds versus playing after the cut. Because at the end of the day, if you're sacrificing your board position and not ensuring that the rest of the table is in the same boat you are in, you're basically handing the game away.
Mm-hmm.
And like you said, Alex, sometimes that's okay, but I have to agree with Mike. It's really tough to include a card that you probably can never use after the cut. That's a tough slot. You know, we were saying that you're probably only using 3 plots, maybe 4, in your plot deck. I still want all my plots to be there so that I can make the right choices with the right plot depending on the situation.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very few and far between that Valor is the right choice after the cut.
Yeah, I agree.
I would agree with that. The games are usually over very quickly, in my experience, after the cut.
All right, so I think we talked a lot about a whole bunch of different aspects of Melee, but I'm still keen on hearing your top picks for the best Melee houses out there right now. What do you think the number one is, Alice? If you had to build a Melee deck today, what house would you be building?
Maybe somewhat surprising, but I think my pick right now would be Targ. There are 4 or 5 builds that I all think are really good in Melee and Targ. They all approach things somewhat differently, but all of them look very threatening, especially with the new Fire Made Flesh type stuff that I think is just so powerful. So they would be my number one pick right now.
And Mike?
It's kind of a toss-up for me between Baratheon and Lannister. You know, Baratheon's the old favorite, and it did get some great new tools, you know, with Melisandre's favor and whatnot. But Lannister's kind of tricky. And I feel like if you play Lannister right in Melee, you can kind of win without anyone realizing that you're winning.
And I think one of the key cards for Lannister and for Martell is the Myrcella to swap titles. It really is a huge point. And then you can, on top of that, have the Varys that allows you to redirect challenges. It can really mess with the opponent's game plan after it's already sort of set in stone, and then just go, nope, yeah, now you have to, you marshaled wrong, turns out.
They have a certain critical mass of tools at this point, I think. Gotten just toolboxy enough that that you could really, really make a solid deck out of them.
And John, what's your pick?
I keep going back and forth, but I'm going to say Baratheon for now. I think Mel's Favor is an extremely powerful card, and it's going to be able to swing you a ton of power. And on top of that, it's also your spot character removal, because if they have a really annoying Viper, for instance, you can just take that Viper and say, free military challenge against this guy right here. Like, who wouldn't take a free unopposed military challenge and know that, you know, that Viper with the five power is going away and you never have to worry about it again? Well, strangely enough, I decided not to use the dupe save. But I think Baratheon's in a really good place. They've always had a lot of stuff to grab power very quickly that hasn't gone away, but now they've started to get some of these toolbox stuff that you guys were talking about. I think that starts to push them over the edge.
I want to mention that the other houses are all competitors. Martell to the Spears is just an amazing card. They have a Maester Rush that's really, really fast. The Red Viper is still an absolutely phenomenal card in Melee. Even the other Red Viper is actually quite good in Melee as well, by losing some challenges and then doing that high claim power reversal. Just choosing the Spear, Deceit, things like that are really, really powerful cards even in Melee.
I say that I think Stark is probably one of the weakest houses. I think there's probably only maybe one really strong Stark build, and that's Siege. I don't know if Stark has the push to do Melee in any other form. What do you guys think?
I would agree with that. The other thing I'll say about Stark, and in particular Siege, is that that deck remains, frankly, largely unchanged. In the past 2-3 years, I mean, that deck is running at least 50 of the same cards. So you kind of know exactly what to expect out of it. So it's not really an unknown, a non-issue. You can kind of predict how it's going to play and the steps it's going to take. And so if you build your deck with that in mind, it's not really a contender, in my opinion.
And then the other house, Greyjoy. Greyjoy does have more and more power cards, a little more acceleration than it used to. People are using some fun tools out of there, like Jack and Hagar, who saw a lot of play at Stalic last year, to close the game down on a Rise of the Kraken turn. You can gain 8 or 9 power, depending on how you do that. So they certainly have punch. There's also Corpse Lake builds that like to use Euron as a deterrent. If you're going to declare a challenge against me, I'll draw a card and claim power, probably, and mill out your deck a little bit, which is demoralizing. All right, well, Mike, thanks for imparting your Wisdom of the Ages Melee Championship tips and tricks so that I can sharpen up my Melee game in time for Canadian Nationals.
Yes, I wish you guys luck. So you do have a Melee component in your Nationals.
We certainly do. Are you going to come to our Nationals?
You are a funny man, especially a funny man with a newborn at home. You should understand my plight a little bit.
It's only a 12-hour drive, Mike. I mean,
only a 12-hour drive. Hey,
there's 3 cars from here doing it for Indianapolis for Gen Con. I don't see why you wouldn't do it for just as big as an event.
Just as big an event, huh?
Well, maybe not at close.
You know what? You tell me it's just as big an event, and I'll come, John. If you can show me that it's going to be just as big an event, and I'll make it happen.
Okay, but let's put it this way: if you win this event, you're North American national champion.
That's true. That's true. Yeah.
All right, so this is the closing segment. Generally, talk about some upcoming regionals. I think I only know of 4. 2 stateside regionals, one in Portland in Oregon, and one in Florida in Palm Bay. And I've been asked to tell people to check out the forum if you're thinking of attending that Florida one. DBunch25 is offering his places to stay. Definitely an opportunity for all of you people who live in places that actually have sun. And then on top of that, there's a regional in Milano in Italy and one in Tasmania in Australia. I don't know how big of a meta there could be in Tasmania, but I hope to hear more of it.
Yeah.
But I know that the weekend after that, there's a very, very big event. There's the Battle of Blackwater Bay, and you're planning on attending that, right?
Yep. It's happening the weekend of 26th and 27th of this month, the same weekend of DC Regional. And it's in London. And we're expecting like 60 people or so from all over 11 countries or so.
Yeah, that's what I saw. I saw in the Skype group, I think both Tagore and JC Wama, who are helping organize this, were boasting how many nationalities. It looked like there were going to be more non-UK players than UK players attending, which is great. I mean, that's what you want at an international event like that. But so this is part of the Road to Stalag, right? This is...
Yes. It's the third one, I think. The first one was Battaglia. Second one was Milano. The third one is this in London.
And then after that, there's the Turning for the Hand in France and the Fleet of Faka
in
Poland, and then Stalag itself. So that means that you get free admission or a first-round buy at Stalag? Is that how it works?
In Milano, it was like that, but I don't know the prices in London. They usually get you a bucket of 100 euros or so.
Oh, okay. That's handy enough. I did see some of the prize support. I think both JC and Tagore were spoiling some of the alternate art cards that were like sort of very British humor of showing the houses at their worst moment. You know, Ned headed and Viserys getting the crown of gold. I don't know if you saw the rest of those yet, or I guess maybe you'll have to share pictures of them 2 weeks from now.
Yeah, I'm sure Tagore or Jace will do that. I don't know. If not, I'll do that.
All right. So I suppose I expect you to win that, by the way.
It's a really tough one.
We keep calling the Spanish meta the best meta in the world. You know?
Yeah, that's really big, but we don't know.
Is anyone else coming from your meta?
Yeah, Jeff and me are going, and then some people from Barcelona, I think they're going.
All right. Okay. Well, thank you very much for doing this last minute, for covering for John. And given that it is late even for a Spaniard, I think I'll let you enjoy what's left of your evening.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to Beyond the Wall. If you have any comments or would like to be featured on the cast, please let us know by email at beyondthewallpodcast@gmail.com or through Facebook at Beyond the Wall Podcast. If you've enjoyed the music, check out more of Antti Martikainen's work at the link embedded in the chapter data. See you all next week.